Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to photographer Colleen Plum about her new book, Animals Are Outside Today, and Ben Swan from the Animal Shelter and Humane Society. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Chris Wood. He is the Vice President for Administration at the Santa Fe Institute, and Greg Heltman, who is the founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. Now, this weekend is Voyages of Discovery, Bach and the Brain. It's the third collaboration, 3 years in a row. These two institutions, the Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute, have been collaborating, bringing together science and music in very interesting ways. This year, Bach and the Brain, what's it all about?
I think Chris, I'm going to defer to Chris.
Okay, thanks.
Here, the reason being is really this nugget of this golden nugget idea was put on the table by Chris, and we were so excited about going forward with it, and I think he's most eloquent in describing the depth of what we're going to be presenting on Sunday.
Well, thanks, Greg. That's very generous. A little too generous, I suspect. The idea basically began a very long time ago, long before I was here, long before I knew anything about the symphony, long before I was with the Santa Fe Institute. And when I was a graduate student and was working on some studies trying to understand brain mechanisms, and in that case of speech perception, someone had on the wall a quote from Aldous Huxley, and this quote has stuck with me for a very long time. I'll use it now. We'll also use it in the program on Sunday. It goes like this: "The hairy endings of the auditory nerve shuddered like weeds in a restless sea. A vast number of obscure miracles were performed in the brain, and Lord Edwards ecstatically whispered, 'Bach.'" Now,
that quote is
really self-explanatory. As a neuroscientist, I'm interested in the vast number of obscure miracles in the brain. It so happens that this quote said Bach. It could just as easily have said, if you transposed the novel written in 1928 to the early 21st century, it could just as easily have said, "A vast number of obscure miracles were performed in the brain, and Lord Edwards ecstatically whispered, 'Schnitke.'" Greg will get that, if nobody else will. And my point is, there is nothing inherently linking the scientific content of this program to Bach. We could perform it with other composers to some loss, but not a great loss. It so happens, though, that Bach is one of my own musical passions, so this coincidence is truly a very, very selfish endeavor on my part.
Well, what's the science component of it?
The concert will consist of an interleaved program of music that Greg will talk about in a moment, I'm sure, interleaved with 3 8- to 10-minute scientific presentations by me that will begin with an examination of what sound looks like in the environment, how sound gets into the brain, what are the mechanisms by which the ear transforms sound in the environment into impulses in the nervous system that the nervous system can process, store, and remember. And we'll then turn, it will follow that information into the brain and turn to the specific mechanisms by which the brain processes sound. And finally, we'll conclude with an examination of what we know about how the brain processes music per se. And are there differences in the brains between musicians and non-musicians, for example?
So, I mean, I think the quotation that you read from Huxley has the word miracles in it, and science is, if anything, a way to turn miracles into non-miracles by explaining things. And there is something that is deeply mysterious to me, maybe to you, maybe not, and that is why music affects us so very, very emotionally when we did not evolve with music.
Well, that's a terrific question. I'll do a typical scientist's reply and first question the premise and then answer the question. We certainly didn't evolve with Bach, Beethoven, and Schnittke, but we did evolve with sound, and part of music is rhythm. Part of music is the kind of sound that people generate when they're at work in the fields. So it's I think it's a little strong to say we didn't evolve with music. We certainly didn't evolve with composed music.
That's what I'm saying.
But it's easy to think of composed music as being an elaboration of the production, the sound production capabilities we already have, and with the sound perception capabilities that we already have.
But when you listen to nature, and you listen to the music of nature, and you listen to bird songs, and you listen to whale songs, and you listen to the wind through the trees, and all of those things have their beauty and their emotional component and so on, but it's, to me at least, maybe I'm wrong, a fundamentally different thing than listening to the music of Bach, or even listening to African drumming, or things that have this human composed complexity that doesn't even have an analog, I don't think, in our closest primates.
Well, I think you're right, and I would simply say composers go to great lengths to take advantage of that relationship and try to maximize it for the artistic purposes of their music. But I would gladly wager you that I could lay out an array of music that somebody somewhere in the world calls the same kind of music that has the emotional appeal to them that you were describing, and you would not find all of it emotionally appealing. So it's a.
Do you think it's mostly cultural, the emotional appeal? It's something that we learn as kids.
I think any nature nurture question of which that is a good example is an oversimplification in the sense that nature and nurture are so deeply intertwined by definition from the bottom up that simply asking is something cultural is, I think, an oversimplification. Things can be predominantly cultural, but anything cultural is riding on top of the underlying biology, and those mutually evolve and those mutually constrain each other in very, very interesting and important ways.
I guess the question is there some kind of universality in the what we experience as the depth of music that is cross-cultural, and how do you understand, again, going back to this question, the fact that we are, whatever our culture is, we tend to be so very deeply affected by music, and there's a part of the brain that processes music, and yet, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, how did that part of the brain evolve?
Well, that's a great question, and if I knew the answer to that in detail, we would be a lot farther along than we are today. But let me say that again, I'm sorry to be picky and overly precise, but what you said was there is a part of the brain that processes music, and that's absolutely right. But it's more than that. There are many parts of the brain that process music, many parts of the brain that process both music and non-musical sounds. And to the best of our knowledge, as yet, there is no specific region of the brain that responds to music and only music. And that's part of the really interesting sense in which the brain is not just an individual collection of regions that do specific things, but rather a highly interconnected network with important properties that are shared in some circumstances, are not shared in others, and it's what makes the brain both one of the most interesting, mystifying organs we know, and yet provides great, great challenges for neuroscience to try to understand.
Greg Heltman, what is actually going to be played, and how did you choose the specific pieces by Bach to relate to the scientific content?
As we were having our discussions over the last 6 to 8 months about this idea, there were a number of pieces that were brought to the table. Chris had quite a lengthy list, and I did too. Stephen Smith, our music director as well, and our principal cellist, Dana Winograd, who participated in the discussions. And as we were going forward, an idea arose of starting with a simpler presentation and then growing till we present the full-size romantic orchestra. And so we're following that model. And we will begin the afternoon, after Chris shares this Aldous Huxley quote with the audience, with a solo performance by David Fellberg of a movement from the Sonata in A minor for solo violin. It's going to be quite dramatic. Following that, the brass quintet will come to the front of the stage and perform the Contrapuntus 1 from The Art of the Fugue. The Art of the Fugue by Bach was really an educational, pedagogical piece that he wrote that went through the various designs of fugal writing, and we're presenting the most simplistic, simplest fugal example with the Contrapuntus number 1. Following that, we are going to go a bit further afield with the Villa-Lobos, Bachianus Brasileiras. Villa-Lobos was very inspired by Bach, as nearly every composer who came after Bach has been, and he wanted to take Bach's models and ideas and put them into a Brazilian idiom. And so the Bachianus Brasileiras for 8 cellos and sopranos is a terrific, terrific example of that style of writing. Our soprano is Natalie Polito, who was one of the second-year apprentices at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. Terrific voice. And then we conclude the first half of the program with the first movement of the Orchestral Suite number 4 in D major. So you see how we grow from one solo instrument to string orchestra with 3 trumpets and timpani. And that's in the first half. In the second half, we go small again with the cantata number 51 for solo, trumpet, soprano, string orchestra. And then we jump to the 21st century with a piece by Paul Moravec entitled Brandenburg Gate. It was commissioned by the Orpheus Ensemble in New York and is modeled on the Brandenburg Concerto number 2. And it features 4 solo instruments, clarinet, trumpet, violin, and flute. And so that's very exciting, very virtuosic. Then we go back into the 20th century with a little piece that I first heard a recording of Benny Goodman playing. It's called Bach Goes to Town.
Nice.
It was written by a British composer, Welsh actually, whose name is Alec Templeton. Alec was born blind, learned to play the piano, became a very successful arranger, pianist, had a TV show in the 50s in the United States with the Cincinnati Symphony, and he wrote a piece called Prelude and Fugue in Swing. And Benny Goodman excerpted the fugue and renamed it Bach Goes to Down. So we'll be playing this big band arrangement with full orchestra. And speaking about full orchestra, we wrap up the afternoon with the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Bach, arranged by Leopold Stokowski.
There was a quote by the abstract expressionist Barnett Newman that goes something like, aesthetics is for artists as ornithology is for birds. To the birds. And I was thinking, I mean, how the brain processes music for you in a way doesn't matter, because the music stands alone whether or not we understand how the mechanism of our human apparatus is dealing with it.
I would agree, and I think that what we've lost over the years is this idea that music, whatever its style, can speak to the hearer at that hearer's level, background. And so as one becomes more exposed to a greater variety and diversity of music, one's appreciation of that diversity also grows. But that in no way is meant as a value judgment to those people who find a great deal of enjoyment and inspiration and emotional connection with rock, hip-hop, jazz, that's why I read the jazz piece on here.
Right.
And those examples, I think, speak to this idea that we are still discovering the emotional connection that our brain superimposes on the actual physics, mechanics of sound waves turned into something we've called music.
Let me reply to that question slightly more generally. One of the deepest mysteries that transcends even the mystery of how music is processed in the brain is, what is the brain basis of our experience? Some people use the word consciousness for that. Others prefer not to. That doesn't matter to me for this purpose. But people experience music. People have a conscious, subjective experience of music that's part of what we all enjoy about music. But there is a lot else going on underneath. And what the relationship is between what's going on underneath that enables us to have that subjective experience is sort of the big number one question in neuroscience that may never be answered. Some people, I think we'll learn a lot more about music in the coming decades, but whether or not we will really be able to understand the neural basis of subjective experience is the $64 question. And I think it's important to recognize in that context that it's the very self-same organ that's trying to do the understanding and trying to do the investigation to understand itself. David Krakauer, a mutual friend.
Another scientist at the Santa Fe Institute.
Yes, thank you. And who's been on your show before, I believe. In his Ulam lectures, Stanislav Ulam lectures on the evolution of intelligence just a few weeks ago.
Which are amazing and which are up on the net for anybody who didn't make it over to the theater.
Exactly. They're on the Santa Fe Institute website, and I urge you, you'll really enjoy them. He led with a quote at one point that said, "It only took 14 billion years for matter to contemplate itself." Now, chew on that for a little bit, and that puts our brains trying to understand themselves and trying to understand how we work to process music in a really appropriate perspective, I think.
On that note, the Santa Fe Institute and the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus collaboration Voyages 3, Music and the Mind, is at the Lenzic this Sunday, October 30th at 4 in the afternoon, Bach and the Brain. And there's also some concerts for young people on Monday.
I was just going to break in to say we've been negligent thus far in this discussion in not mentioning the fact that an equal part of this collaborative effort is an educational outreach effort, two concerts Monday morning for fourth graders around the Santa Fe school system. The symphony has done outreach concerts like this for much longer than the collaboration has been in existence, and we are really honored to be included in that outreach, and look forward to presenting a reduced version of both the music and the scientific components of the program twice on Monday morning at the Lenzic.
Chris Wood is the Vice President for Administration at the Santa Fe Institute. Greg Heltman is the Founder and General Director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. For tickets, 988-1234. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ben Swan. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. He writes about animals for the Santa Fe New Mexican, and this is our monthly animal segment. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure, as always, to be here.
And joining us by telephone, we have a special treat. Colleen Plum is with us. She is a photographer, and her new book is called Animals Are Outside Today. It's published by Radius Books of Santa Fe, and there's going to be a book signing at Radius Books on October 29th. That is this coming Saturday from 4 to 6 in the afternoon, and you, Colleen, will be here. Welcome. Let's talk about this very unusual book. It's a book
of photographs of animals, but it's not animals in the wild. It's not like nature photography at all. It's more like animals in zoos, animals in paintings, and in sort of popular culture, trapped animals, dinosaur bones in museums, animals as food, you know, meat, things like that. How did you come to this idea of doing this book?
Well, I originally started thinking about all of the ways that animals are woven into our lives through sort of their representation. So I started out like thinking about this idea of artifice and why we surround ourselves with the artificial and what does that serve? You know, what sort of instinct are we satisfying by having just even the substitution around us? And then it just grew. It just grew over the years where I kept digging and getting more into photographing the real animals. And the more I looked, the more I would see how everywhere I look, there's some form of an animal or how it is used as a resource or how we use them and how they're woven, you know, into our life.
This idea of artificial animals, you know, painting them, making little animals, and why we do that, and sort of contemplating that, what did you come up with?
Well, I think that it really just evolved from my personal, you know, just my life, and then having kids, I saw how many animals were around us in a different way. You know, for instance, just going to this market to get some milk with my daughter, this Middle Eastern market, and there's a head of a lamb in the case. She had a friend with her, and they were looking at its eyeball, and I was like, oh God, I have to come back and photograph that. And then I thought, oh, I should buy it. I'm going to buy that lamb head. And then they both got all upset at the prospect of me carrying this head out with me. So I sort of had to do it on the sly to buy this head. It was $3, which I thought was absurdly inexpensive. You know, I thought, geez, a head of a lamb, you know, what a lamb used to mean as a sacred offering versus, you know, it's now made, I guess it's a soup, you know, when you boil the head. So, you know, I brought it home and photographed it, and then we brought it to the park to bury it and said a prayer and thanked it, you know, to give it somewhat of a better send-off. But also that, you know, I'm not saying like it's horrible to make soup with a head. It's just that, you know, what was the life of that lamb? You know, that's where my questioning is what sort of a life did that lamb have? And hopefully in an ideal world, the lamb could have a good life, a happy life.
Well, and this is one of the things that I think your book brings up is the question of, I mean, everybody dies, every living thing dies, and there are some dead animals that seem to have died naturally. There are dead animals that are domesticated and used for meat. There's ones that maybe were trapped in some human-made enclosure that never would have died if it weren't for these complex human structures. And it just leads to this whole contemplation of what any animal's life is like. And even if the picture doesn't tell you that, you wonder how it has suffered or not.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, that I did, you know, one of those threads became about death. And that's, you know, part of the reality. I mean, there's a realistic view of like, okay, we have animals, we've used them from the beginning, you know, when we first hunted and killed animals. And that, you know, this idea of being so cut off from those early experiences where there was a sacredness or an importance and a value to every single part of the animal, and that you know, its life, it was just sort of a given that it had a natural life. Well, we've become so far removed from giving an animal a natural life that it's hard. I mean, it's hard to not feel really complicit in this horrible life that animals have just by being part of our society. If, you know, just reading in Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma about that, if all of the factories had glass walls, you know, things would change pretty quickly. We would see. So there's this cutting off of seeing. We don't want to see the real head or the eyeball. We want it to be as far removed from what we could have identified with it, you know, like it identified with its suffering. Or so, like Bella on the road, we were driving to go ice skating, and I saw this dog out of the corner of my eye as we drove past, and I was like, oh my God, that was a dog. Like, I couldn't believe it. And it was so sad, and the kids, we kept going, and I dropped them off, and I went back. And so that one speaks to, like, the reality that there are roads and there's death and that animals they're harmed. We take the land and they don't have space, and it's really not fair, I think, you know, to animals. But I did just read that there's a decline in deer's getting hit by cars. Did you hear about that?
Because of the way they're building roads with...
No, that they're either drivers are getting smarter, but they think that deer are getting smarter. That the deer are getting
That's
smarter.
That's nice.
So, I know. It's kind of a phenomenon, you know.
I guess, like, it's yet another example of natural selection. Deer who know how to avoid the roads tend to reproduce.
Right, they look both ways.
Well, I would have to say that, you know, looking at your book and your art is very intriguing. And, you know, I won't deny that there's a few images that are very disturbing to me, but...
Ben's a vegetarian.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm a vegetarian who grew up in Alaska who's used to the spring when the moose are crossing the roads and everybody hits moose and there's pickup files of bodies and things of these poor calves that are being hit. So I can really relate to the idea of animals being hit. But I wanted to say your photos really spark a curiosity, I think, in the person looking at them, trying to... you know, figure them out, you know, trying to understand, is this a joke or are you trying to hurt us? Or are you trying to, you know, and right. I love that idea that there's always a mystery to each image, you know, and what, how that brings you into where your state of mind was at the time. So I really appreciate that. And also the fact that the animals are so a part of our lives. I was only disappointed that I didn't see any Hello Kitty images in your book. And I love Hello Kitty.
That is my 5-year-old. Amazing.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, and you have a little daughter and no Hello Kitties. That's funny.
I know, that's funny. Well, we have a lot of Hello Kitty around the house, believe me. But that's, you know, a good point, that curiosity. I think that's what, that it is so complex that I'm not going to say, you know, don't do things. My wish is that we will eventually get to a place in our culture where we're more conscious, where the walls will be glass, and we won't be able to eat food that is factory farmed. We just won't be able to. I think that is my hope, you know, that we will eventually get to that. So it's maybe baby steps or raising the questions, you know, as the first, which a lot of people are and have been. You know, I'm just part of the line of trying to hopefully raise consciousness somehow.
Definitely, that's a part of it, that conscious living, which is not just taking things, oh, this hamburger didn't ever exist in a living being, but being aware constantly of what you are, how you affect it, how you affect change as well. If you don't want to be a vegetarian, or if you want to be a vegetarian, you stop eating meat and somehow really embracing, you know, what you're doing each step of the way. So your book really helps people think about those things.
Oh, good. I mean, I hope. I'm not a vegetarian, but I do have, I mean, I have a hard time eating pork, and that I'm very conscious of where I get meat, you know, and so I serve meat. I'm still evolving in that department. Like, I've tried to be a vegetarian, and it doesn't, I feel maybe I've done it wrong, where it doesn't feel good for me, health-wise, but... you know, it's not like I eat that much either, which perhaps smaller amounts, or, you know, that it's really unsustainable the way we've been eating meat and the way that it's going, so.
But I love the fact that you had this ritual with this lamb's head, you know, and you took it out. And you know, like many people think that if you say thank you, if you thank the animal or whatever for its body, that it somehow makes it better. And it does, I think, in a lot of ways, because you make it, it's a conscious decision.
Yeah, I mean, that it gives it that sacredness. And that if we ingest food, you know, I believe this, that if you ingest food that is brutal, with brutality, you're eating that. And I know that, you know, I've read a lot of the Buddhist teachings that when you ingest, it becomes part of you. And so I just read about the eggs that hens, they just sort of have it the worst. I didn't even know that. I mean, I get free-range eggs, but if my daughter, if my 10-year-old had it, you know, she'd have us on a farm raising so that we could look the animal in the eye that we will later eat, and that somehow that feels better and is more just because it had that. This is in Poland's book, too, that idea of a happy animal.
Yeah, I'm still looking for, and it's probably around, but happy pig bacon.
I can only think of Babe.
Could maybe eat, yeah.
No, but there is a, I mean, I think one of the contrasts in your book is between how terribly we treat animals on the one hand, and I mean, it's not that you have pictures of factory farms and things like that, but so many people know about it, and that context is in our mind, and there's so many urban pictures and roadkill and things like that. How badly we treat animals on the one hand, and how much we sentimentalize them on the other hand, and adore their cuteness. And the front picture of the cover picture of the book has somebody wearing a shirt with a deer and a little fawn emblazoned on it, and it's just a kind of not overly disturbing, but just strangely, slightly disturbing book, and it's really great in that way.
Yes, I think it is really contradictory. You know, we can eat them and kill them and cage them and do, you know, test them, and then, you know, love them and have these deep relationships with animals, and you know, care, you know, they become so important to us, and right, and then the icon, you know, they become the symbol, like we use them so, you know, in so many ways. I think like corporate symbols, use the eagle and all the what an animal can symbolize. So we sort of take what we like, you know, we'll take these powerful symbols and use them, but then also, you know, not really. Zoos are really the hardest thing, because you go there and it's like, oh, this is supposed to be a majestic lion, and yet it's, you know, wasting. They're so they just seem so forlorn and not healthy looking. So it's,
well, and they're sort of the way we are when you put us in a room with a lot of junk food and television set.
Yes, exactly. It's not a good recipe to be in a cage, you know, in a cage or on display, or and without exercise, I think, you know, you lose your mind. But you know, but then it's endlessly contradictory, because, or complex, I guess, that would we, at the expense of the one animal in a zoo, you know, which is terrible, does it create more caring for animals in general? I mean, I don't think it's really worth it to that one animal, because it's so bad for them. Personally, you know, I think that zoos, we have to come up with a different way. But there is a value. I mean, I've been doing this video project on elephants, and so there is people, their breath you know, kids are filled with glee when they first see an elephant, but to the expense of those creatures, you know. So it's very complicated, and you know, I couldn't begin to have the answer. You know, zoos have been important to me. Like when I was a kid, I remember going. I also remember being really bored, really hot, wanting to go, you know. So maybe zoos, I've noticed they're moving, like they always have water park things going on or other things. So maybe zoos can be turned more into that type of thing. And
they can evolve.
Yeah, they have evolved, and they really are working on the habitat. And I was thinking about you being hot. I always loved to go into the bat caves and watch the bats. And nice and cool.
Yeah.
Right, it's cool.
Colleen Plum is a photographer. Her new book is called Animals Are Outside Today. And there's some nice text in the book as well. Colleen Plum will be at Radius Books here in Santa Fe for a book signing this Saturday, the 29th of October, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. And Radius Books, well, let's see. You can just give them a call at 983 4068 here in Santa Fe and find out where they are. They're right downtown. Colleen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I can't wait to be in Santa Fe in a few days.
We'll see you then.
Thank you, Colleen.
Thank you very much.
So, Ben Swan, there's a lot of things going on, of course, as always, at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and it's also Halloween coming up on Monday.
Yes,
so
it is.
Is that a big day for pets, besides the fact that some people do tend to dress them up in silly costumes?
It is a big day for pets. Well, every day is a big day for pets, but as you know, Halloween gives everybody the opportunity to do things like Howl-loween. And, you know, do kind of little jokes about the Halloween things. But I did want to, before we get into the very traditional.
I have to tell you, my dog Milk has started howling in his sleep. He howls like a wolf while lying on
that.
His
you
chair. It's so messed up. Anyway, go ahead.
So what I did want to, before we got into the traditional Halloween stuff, talk a little bit about our Dia de los Amigos. That's our Day of the Dead altar. At the shelter, which we have this wonderful shelter volunteer, Mariah, and I've always mispronounced her name. Sorry about that. She's from Spain, and traditionally it's not been part of the Day of the Dead to honor
Mireia.
Mireia, yes. Sorry, thank you. I meant to phonetically spell it out, and I forgot to. But traditionally, it's not been, you know, honoring animals is relatively new. And I talked to her a little bit about that, about the Day of the Dead, how we convert that into our paying tribute to beloved pets. And she was very clear in the fact that, you know, as pets have become part of our families, they, you know, more and more, it's just become almost a tradition in itself that we want to honor those beloved pets and tell and remind people how beautiful they are and how much they impacted our lives. And this is the second year that she's really taken it on herself to create these wonderful altars with photos and candles and flowers and little tributes to the. And we encourage everyone in the public to come by and leave their photo and write a little tribute to their departed pet, and to just remember them with a smile on our faces and to celebrate their lives and how much they touched us.
A lot of people have their pets' ashes if the pets were cremated, mm-hmm. and they build little altars in their houses and things like that. And they do that down at the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary as well.
Ula has a wonderful altar for all the wonderful pets who have gone through Kindred Spirits, and that's in the same vein. Yeah, and I know a lot of people who have altars. I have an altar of my beloved pets, and I bring them in and take them to the altar. But anyway, that will be up until November 1st.
Oh, okay. So people can come by with pictures of their animals.
Yes, and, you know, maybe a little story if they want, maybe, you know, to leave it there. So they're remembered. They always are with us in our memories, and so why not publicly?
On a much more practical note, Halloween.
Yes.
Make sure your dogs don't eat chocolate or raisins.
Yes, not just that. There's also all kinds of candies.
They shouldn't eat any candy.
Any candies, no.
But especially chocolate and grapes.
Yeah, they do actually have dog biscuits that are sort of in shapes of candies and things like that, which is kind of confusing for some animals. So just, yeah, there's a few tips I kind of wanted to tell people about, you know, especially that's the number one about candies and chocolate and things like that, to make sure those animals, and also, you know, even organic pumpkins and stuff like pumpkin guts, they won't kill a dog, but it can get them really sick. You know,
really?
Yeah.
I used to feel when my old dachshund had pancreatitis, we would feed him pumpkin.
Well, it's usually
canned pumpkin.
Cooked pumpkin.
Yeah.
I'm talking about raw pumpkin.
Ah, raw pumpkin is different.
And remember when you have like your candle and your pumpkin, watch out for those tails. They might knock over a pumpkin. They might start a fire.
And set the entire neighborhood on fire.
Luckily, it's not like Christmas, but you should be just aware of those things. And you know, trick-or-treating is a lot of fun for everyone, but not necessarily for dogs or cats. All these people that come into your door, knocking on your door, ringing your bell, wearing these... Imagine it from a dog's perspective, whose really mission is to protect your person.
Right.
You have all these people coming to your door wanting things.
Ready to play a trick, too. Ready to egg your house.
Exactly.
If you don't give them candy.
Dogs love tricks, and they love their treats, but it's best just to put them in the back room or someplace safe where they won't have to be... you know, that stress level is very difficult for them. And then if you do want to take your dog or cat trick-or-treating with you as you go through the neighborhood, just remember that, you know, make sure that they have proper ID, their collar, their tags. You know, you're really busy with your kids. You're watching other things. Sometimes dogs aren't the best beings to have with you when you're out with a bunch, which crowds, you know, they might get lost. And also think about reflective tape for them. So if they're walking across the street with you,
tape their mouth shut,
tape their bodies, or put lights on them. Really cute lights they have now, just so drivers know they're there. And if you do want to go into it, and I love, okay, everybody loves, many people love dressing up their dogs and their cats in Halloween costumes, you know, but some dogs just don't like it. So the best thing to do is
a lot of dogs don't like it. I tell you that one year I bought my dog Honey a Dalmatian sweater? It was a white sweater with black spots, and I put it on her for Halloween. Then I went out to a Halloween party. When I came back, she was lying there without the sweater, and the sweater was completely vanished. It was never found again. It's either she ate it, or she buried it, or she flushed it down the toilet.
Well, Mary Charlotte, you know, some dogs have different fashion sense than we do. What you might think they look great in, they just don't like that at all.
Well, I think what it is dogs have a very different experience of having things around their bodies. It's
exactly the point.
It doesn't feel good to them.
So that's one thing to test out. You know, anything that inhibits their movement, their hearing, their eyes, things like that. There's a lot of costumes out there that are very elaborate. They don't have to be that way. A scarf, a bandana is fun, right?
Right.
So you don't have
a neckerchief.
A neckerchief. You don't have to be so crazy.
And if you absolutely must, a tutu.
Tutu, terrible. But everybody loves to do a Halloween party, and there's several pet stores that are having some Halloween costume parties. I think Zoe and Guido's party is from 4 to 6.
For animals and people.
And Tekatoo is also having, from noon to 3, they're having a costume party. These are just fun things to do if you really want, you know, animal-specific events that, you know, they know what to do. They can watch your costumes, things like that. And at the shelter, we're not doing anything, you know, I've been encouraging people. You know, I have really cool hats, so I kind of wanted to do another costume contest for the shelter employees, but they just are not into it, you know, so I'll just have to wear the hat another time. But we do have some specials going on for the Halloween. So,
oh, tell us about that.
Well, we do take photos of dogs in nice, dogs that like it in nice costumes. You should look at our website. We're upgrading it.
Yeah, I guess some dogs like it more than others.
They do. Like a sweater, you know.
Try to get any of my dogs into a sweater, but never mind. Go ahead.
Sometimes some dogs find that comforting. Well, we have this, you know, throughout the month we're having it's Adopt a Shelter Dog Month. And on our website, I've been doing a new little factoid about dogs, you know, what you can do with them, what you shouldn't do with them. And it's just fun things to do. And in that vein, we're letting people pick the discount, their adoption discount from a big Halloween plastic pumpkin. So it's a way of getting, you know, it's just having fun. With the bird. And then at the, you know, we have a Look What the Cat Dragged In, which is our resale store. And everybody who comes in with a costume, they get 30% off. You don't even have to scare us.
I could come in as Ben Swan wearing a cardigan.
You could, and you could wear my new hat that I just got.
That's right. Ben Swan, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take a picture of him and put it up on the website. So by the time you hear this, there will be, or in a few minutes, there will be a picture of Ben Swan in his very, very dapper new hat on the website. And there's great stuff at Look What the Cat. I want to say drug in. That's not right.
No. We just call it the cat. Makes it easier.
All right.
Yeah, every morning I wake up and say, what funny hat do I want to wear? But this one's a little dapper. I think, you know,
super slick.
The whole 50s kind of revival has really gotten back into it. And I happened to be at this cat conference in Los Angeles over the weekend, and had to pick up this beautiful new hat. Anyway, Mary Charlotte will take a photo of me, and unfortunately you'll be disappointed about what you see, because I do have the face for radio.
You look good in that hat, I'll tell you that. Now, let's talk about, and also because I've been putting pictures on the website, santafe.radiocafe.org, let's talk about some of the animals, because I want to put those, he's holding up two pictures, and I'm going to put those on the website as well. These are a dog, a light dog and a dark cat.
Yeah, and, you know, when I heard that Mary Charlotte had the capability of putting photos on her website,
I thought I've always had it. I just didn't know how to do it until about a week ago.
Well, it might have been a little bit longer. But I thought, you know, when we talk about these animals, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and she only gives me 900. So I figured.
Let's talk about these animals.
Oh, yeah. Polo, you know, here's Polo. Polo is one of our longest resident cats at the shelter. He's not a resident cat. He's looking for a home. He's been there for over a year. And he's a black Maine Coon mix. With
You're
a,
kidding.
Yeah.
Nobody adopted that cat. He's so cute.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they get overlocked.
He's got a long, fluffy tail and green, seductive eyes, and he's a fluffy black cat.
Yeah, and so Catherine, one of our adoption counselors, was talking about him. A lot of people love this cat, and some cats just, you know, don't connect with people. He's got a little bit of, you know, he's got some issues, like he's slightly nervous about handling, and doesn't like people pulling him off his, you know, onto their, you know, pulling him up off the ground.
Swinging him by the tail.
Yeah, exactly. But he is a great cat. He loves to be indoors and outdoors. He gives kitty kisses, love nips, and... as Catherine says, may surprise you with every day with his antiques.
Oh.
He's just a sweet cat. And then this guy, Charlie Bear, has really fallen in love. The shelter staff has really fallen in love with him.
I would take that dog home in a minute.
And look at that festive kerchief.
He's wearing a neckerchief.
Yes. He's playful, curious, friendly, and a water lover.
How big is he?
Well, he looks like he's, I would say, 40 pounds.
He's a blonde dog with pointy ears. Looks like he has a little bit of shepherd and chow in him. Imagine that in New Mexico.
Yeah, and he's got a very inquisitive face, doesn't he? He's very curious about a lot of things. So he's is a mix of Siberian Husky and Chow Chow. They call him the
king. Ah, Siberian Husky. Okay.
Yeah, they call him the king of the pool because he loves to play. And he's somewhat independent, but he's very loving. He's 2 years old, tan and white, and he can be a little shy. But, you know, we have this wonderful behavior department, and eventually I'll get him on, and we can talk about, you know, all the things that we're doing to really just a lot of our dogs that come in through various reasons, and the trust has been broken a little bit, and it takes some time to understand that people are good too, and so that's why our behavior staff has been really working with these dogs, and they really turn around within 24 hours, or, you know, some dogs take a bit longer, but you would be surprised that we have a humane walking. A lot of volunteers do our humane walking program. They just take them around, and they love their surroundings. And then I also wanted to say, you know, in Albuquerque, they've had some terrible hoarding cases this summer. And it's really impacted the shelter. And we have been fortunate enough that we've been really working hard on getting homes for our critters. And we've been taking some animals from Albuquerque. Last week, we took about 12 cats. And this week, just yesterday, we picked up 11 dogs. And most of them are little dogs. We call them Littles, Cheese. And in fact, and I think there was one boxer.
Chihuahua.
Cheese, yeah, which I have. Olivia is a very sweet dog. And the behavior director was telling me that when they had selected these dogs, they picked 11. And this couple had been following them around. And before they left the shelter grounds, somebody had already adopted 2 of the dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
So you know the quality of these dogs are going to be great. And I just wanted to say that the more dogs and cats that we can find homes for, the better we are able to serve Albuquerque and help other relieve the overcrowding problems there.
I've just started reading a book called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. It's not a new book. It's a few years old.
It's an awesome book.
It's really good. Yeah. And the main point, I mean, I can't fully recommend it in the sense that I haven't finished it yet, but so far, so good. I mean, anyway, I hear it's a great book, so I do recommend it by Alexandra Horowitz. But the main point of it is that everything a dog does is an attempt to communicate, and
in
the fact
way.
That we don't understand it means that we need to learn, because once we learn what they're trying to communicate, then we can deal with their behavior issues or problems.
It's always a first step in understanding what a dog is trying to tell you.
Yeah.
And they sometimes mimic us, but is it comprehension? I don't know. And that's why Temple Grandin, also an author who's written Animals in Translation and many other
yeah.
books, she provides, as an autistic woman, she provides a lot of insight into the how our minds work, how their minds work, and how they can connect. That's an awesome book to recommend.
Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. He writes about animals for the Santa Fe New Mexican. And how do people get in touch with you and with the shelter?
I'm at the shelter every day, but they can always email me at bswan@sfhumanesociety.org. And go to we have a shelter website, we have a shelter Facebook, and you can also send story ideas and things to scoop@gmail.com. That's santafescoop@gmail.com.
santafescoop@gmail.com. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Mary Charlotte, that was awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.